Right now, like it or not, it's the beginning of cold and flu season. If you're an overachiever, you may have already gotten your flu shot. And if not, this year's options may be a little different.
Flu Mist, the nasal spray vaccine, isn't an option this year, which means adults and kids alike will have to get the flu shot if they want to get vaccinated against likely strains of flu this year.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty joins us now. He's a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and former chair of the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Greetings, and I hope you're enjoying this beautiful day.
It is nice out there. It seems hard to think about getting sick, getting the flu, and yet I guess we have to start thinking about that. Has the flu hit Wisconsin yet?
Not really at all, and there has been virtually no influenza across North America at this point in time. There's just very, very low levels, but this is what we typically see in September, and as we get into late fall and early winter, we will definitely see influenza come back.
So does that mean this is the time to get immunized, or can we wait a little while?
Most experts will say this is a very good time right now. I think any time from early September until well into the influenza season is an okay time. But because this is a very good way to prevent influenza, trying to get the flu vaccine in at least 2 weeks before influenza is circulating is a really good idea.
Well, let's talk about those options for right now. What can we do? We have the shot. We used to have the mist. Is the mist not off the table now?
Well, it's a very interesting situation with the mist because this is a vaccine that in the past few years has been used by roughly one-third of Wisconsin children that get influenza vaccine. Unfortunately, only overall about one-third of Wisconsin children get vaccinated each year. And of those, about one out of three get the flu mist. So it means this year that potentially about 120,000 children will have to make a different choice, and that choice is going to be an injection.
Right. I mean, kids are not, if my kids are any judge, are not big fans of needles. What's the reason behind the flu mist not being available this year?
Well, every year in June, the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices makes recommendations for the United States in terms of what vaccines to use and other methods to control influenza. And each year they review the past performance of vaccines and make determinations as to what the best selection of vaccines are going to be for the coming year. The biggest problem there, however, is we are always looking backward, and we're never able to quite know what's going to be coming in the year ahead. And so it's a little bit of guesswork. But the decision was based on the fact that the flu mist or the live attenuated influenza vaccine was showing fairly low performance or protection against the strain that was circulating last year. And so the advisory committee decided to not recommend that vaccine, but recommend instead the injectable.
So it sounds like the flu mist was low performing last year, but why does that mean we'll also assume it would perform low on this year's strains? I mean, my understanding is that every year you may get a slightly different cocktail of flu strains going around.
Well, and therein lies the problem, because the flu viruses we're seen circulating over the summer tend to be of a strain that this vaccine actually worked fairly well against. And so we won't know whether or not this was a good decision until late December or January.
So this is an interesting question. And I know that some people who opt not to get the flu shot use the argument something along the lines that, well, they don't really know what's going to be going around anyway, so why should I get a shot when it's just sort of an educated guess? What do you say to that?
Well, there's a couple ways to respond to that. First of all, the methods we have to estimate how well a flu shot is working are, at least in my estimation, not the best answer. When my research group has looked at this here in Wisconsin, what we found is even if you come down with a flu after receiving an influenza vaccine, which would traditionally be characterized as a vaccine failure, but in those people who have had the flu vaccine, you're less likely to have a flu-like illness. You're less likely to have a fever. You're less likely to feel sick. And so there's something called partial protection, and none of us really do a very good job of measuring that. And so that's one of the little issues out there that I think we need better research going forward to make better decisions.
But is it the CDC that does this, that decides, puts together the year's flu vaccine?
Well, this is a decision by CDC and the World Health Organization in late February, early March. They will get together and determine what strains are circulating at the end of our influenza season in the Northern Hemisphere and what viruses are circulating in the Southern Hemisphere. And from that, they determine which types of viruses to put into the vaccine. But then during the flu season, there's something called the Flu Vaccine Efficacy Network. And here in Wisconsin, it actually includes Marshfield Clinic. But this group is charged with looking at how well that vaccine is working during the current year. That information is provided to the CDC and to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, typically before June, so decisions can be made during the June meeting and allow us to prepare for the coming flu year.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty is with us right now. He's a professor of family medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and former chair of the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. We're talking about this year's flu season and, of course, the flu vaccine.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the flu vaccine? And we have a question for you. Are you getting it? Have you gotten the flu shot already? If you work in healthcare, are you gearing up to give lots of shots? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about this year's flu season now and looking at what options are out there for getting vaccinated. And we want to hear from you. Are you going to get the flu shot this year? Are you going to get it for your family? Do you get it every year? Are you less likely to get the flu shot this year because there's no nasal mist option available? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty stays with us. He's a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and a former chair of the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And Dr. Tempty, we have a question here from Barbara in Milwaukee who says when she was getting cancer treatment, she was told not to get a flu shot. She wants to know who shouldn't get a flu shot.
Well, in fact, I think that was wrong information. People who are undergoing cancer chemotherapy should never receive a live virus vaccine, but the regular vaccine is not only perfectly fine, but would be indicated for anybody whose immune system might be at greater risk for having a bad case of influenza. So the only people who should not be receiving influenza vaccine are people who have allergies to the components of the vaccine, or who have had a bad reaction in the past to the vaccine.
So not a very large group of people. And what are the figures on how many people actually do get vaccinated each year?
Well, unfortunately, in our very own state of Wisconsin, we do a terrible job of immunizing the group of people I think that are some of the most important to protect, and those are school-aged children. And what I can tell you is this group of people tend not to have a lot of problem with hospitalization. They tend not to be the people who die of influenza, but they are incredibly, incredibly important of spreading influenza throughout our state. When we look at kids basically from the age of 2 in daycare up through 17 and 18 in high school, they congregate, you know, on a daily basis with friends and acquaintances and classmates, and they do a really good job of spreading this. And then they take it home to their mothers, fathers, siblings, sometimes babies, brothers and sisters and grandparents, and therein lies a lot of the problem. So in Wisconsin, we only immunize about one out of every three school-age children. We do pretty good with older adults over the age of 65, and I think we get maybe 65% of those. But across the working ages, we tend to be relatively low as well, typically under 30 to 40%. And so there's a lot of people that are missing the benefit of influenza vaccine.
Let's take another caller here. Cindy joins us from Grant County. Cindy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I have a question about the vaccine. I have had the flu vaccine every year. I'm diabetic. I also have an autoimmune condition called Sjogren's, which, of course, makes me more susceptible to respiratory and flu-type illnesses. So I've always had it. And I have elderly parents, one of whom's in memory care and cannot take a vaccine because of previous reactions, and a father who is also immune-compromised with Sjogren's. And my concern comes from the fact that I've read some things. I'm not into the anti-vax thing at all, but I've read some things about that the vaccine given to someone with my kinds of immune issues could actually be a cause of a worse flu, and I just wanted to address that with the doctor.
Okay, Cindy, thanks. Interesting question there. Is there anything to what Cindy has read about maybe the vaccine making the flu worse if she does get it?
Well, there is no evidence that receipt of a vaccine will make a future case of influenza worse than had you not had the vaccine at all. And even if your immune system is somewhat compromised, we do get protection. And that's why we recommend influenza vaccine, especially, not only to everyone, but especially people who have high-risk conditions or have immunocompromise. The biggest concern with individuals with immune compromise is they may not have as good of a response to the vaccine in terms of protection.
Well, Cindy, thank you so much for the call. I hope that helps. And Dr. Tempty, just briefly as we wrap up, what would you say to people, and maybe parents, if you want to get that immunization rate up for that school-age children group, what would you say to parents and young people about why they should get vaccinated?
Well, I think it's very important not only for individual protection, but also for the people that you come into contact with every day. About across the United States, at any one time, there are 10 million people who are immunocompromised, either from cancer chemotherapy or from drugs that we use for rheumatoid arthritis and for other reasons. And these are people who may not be able to defend themselves with their immune system, even if they are vaccinated. So not only immunizing ourselves to prevent illness, and I get my flu shot every year, and in my profession, I'm around a lot of sick people, and I have not had flu at all, so that's great. But we not only do it for ourselves, but for all those people that we come into contact with and for our families.
Dr. Tempty, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
And thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
You too. That was Dr. Tempty. He's a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, former chair of the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices.
Please join in with your support of Wisconsin Public Radio at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Make that pledge now. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Last night was the first and only vice presidential debate of this election cycle at Longwood University in Farmville, Virginia. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine and Republican Governor Mike Pence faced off last night.
Barbara Perry is with us now to break down that debate. She's a professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, a debate on your home turf in Virginia there. I wanted to get your big picture reaction. Is this a debate that provided valuable, useful information to voters trying to decide who to vote for?
I think it did. I think it did in both its substance and its tone. We obviously would like to see, in political science, we'd like to see a little bit more detail about the policies, but they certainly did get into some policy areas, both domestic and foreign, and talk about them. And then there was a sense of the personalities of the two men, although I think in the case of Senator Kaine, and we know him very well here, of course, in Virginia. In fact, I've met him off and on over the years. That really wasn't, I think, his genuine personality, so I'm not sure how helpful that was. But I think what he was doing was following the directions of his campaign to go ahead and really take it to Trump and take it to the governor of Indiana as well.
Yeah, let's talk about style for a bit, and then we'll get into some of the policy issues, and we'll stay with Senator Kaine. People pointed out he was interrupting a lot. People were trying to compare and contrast if he interrupted maybe even more than Donald Trump did in the first presidential debate. As people watch that, I mean, does people forming that opinion of a candidate's personality in the course of a debate, is that useful? Should it be useful information, and does it sway voters whether that's good or not?
I think it can be useful information, although for the vice presidency, as we know, it's a secondary office, though it can be a heartbeat away from the presidency. So it's not unimportant. I think that if Senator Kaine had been running for the presidency, the personality that he developed for this event might have been more hurtful, in fact, than helpful. So I would say it gave us a sense of what Governor Pence wanted to do, which was show himself in contrast both on policy and style and personality to Donald Trump, and again in the case of Senator Kaine, to go on attack mode. Again, those of us who know him here in Virginia know that that's really not his personality. So that could be something, though, that people want to take into consideration. Is this person behaving in a way that they find acceptable or not? But given that it's the secondary office, typically vice presidential debates don't move the needle very much on the polls or on the election day.
And some people have pointed out maybe it wasn't so much about Senator Kaine. It was more what he had Governor Pence saying during this debate. And then, lo and behold, I think before the night was even done, there was a Hillary Clinton campaign commercial contrasting Governor Pence saying Donald Trump didn't say that with samples of Donald Trump saying a particular thing.
Yes, I think that's always then what happens in the 24 hours to 48 hours and then the next week, as we saw with the first presidential debate. So it's the event itself. How do the people at the event, the two candidates, portray themselves? What do they say? What's the content? And then how is that developed? Are the things that go wrong really picked up by the opposition, and do they run with it, as in the case of Trump or maybe in the case of Pence last night, where clearly he was trying to draw a distinction between himself and the top of the ticket, but also trying somehow to duck as best he could some of the more outrageous things and claims that have been made by the top of his own ticket.
Yeah, this seems like it fits into a thing we've been seeing lately, where the one thing each campaign wants to be talking about is the other candidate and their negatives. The Clinton campaign, it seems to do best when people are talking about Donald Trump's problems. Trump campaign does best when people are talking about Hillary Clinton's problems. It seems like both vice presidential candidates were trying to go there as much as they possibly could.
Yes. I should think, first of all, as we know, we're not discovering something new here, but sadly, this is where our politics have gone. But let's also remember our founding. You know, here at the Miller Center at UVA, a university founded by Thomas Jefferson, we do look back at history, and to go back and look at some of the things that the founders said about each other, especially when they split into the first two political parties, and to look at things that were said about Thomas Jefferson, this is not completely new, but I think we've taken it perhaps to a new low, especially with social media. So it's not something new, and I think we should also put into this mix the fact that we do have two candidates at the top of the ticket with very high unfavorability ratings. So each of the campaigns is playing off of that from the opposition side. And again, let's face it, in the case of Donald Trump, he has said and done some pretty outrageous things. In the case of Mrs. Clinton, she's been around for so long, there are so many things that she can be attacked on.
Talking to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking at last night's running mate debate, the vice presidential debate. Let's give a listen now, get into some of the issues that came up. Foreign policy, a biggie. Here's a clip of Governor Pence criticizing Hillary Clinton on her policy of a Russian reset when she became Secretary of State.
After the Russian reset, the Russians invaded Ukraine and took over Crimea. And the small and bullying leader of Russia is now dictating terms to the United States to the point where all the United States of America, the greatest nation on earth, just withdraws from talks about a ceasefire while Vladimir Putin puts a missile defense system in Syria while he marshals the forces and begins. Look, we have got to begin to lean into this with strong, broad-shouldered American leadership.
So it's kind of a double-edged nature of that there, criticizing, of course, the Obama policies and foreign policy and Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Talk about Russia, though, and criticizing Putin. A lot of people have made a lot of Donald Trump saying what sound like really favorable things about Putin.
Yes, that was one of the oddest moments, I thought, in the debate last night, that clearly Governor Pence is looking down the road to his own run probably 4 years from now, so trying to separate himself from Donald Trump, understandably, on that, but also having some valid contact points, I think, for attacking Secretary Clinton on the so-called Russian reset that really appears, as we look back, not to have helped Russian-U.S. relations at all, but then again to say, I think that this, this president and the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, have not done enough on the Russian front, if you will. First of all, you've got Secretary of State Kerry doing everything possible. There'd be nothing he would like more than to try to end the conflict in Syria by going to the table over and over again, trying to work out something with the Syrians and the Russians and the rebels. So it's not as though this administration hasn't been trying, but there are, again, valid criticisms that could be labeled. But I think if you circle back then to what Trump has said about Putin, not to mention that we think, of course, that Trump has had business dealings with the oligarchy in Russia, pretty hard for Mike Pence to just ignore that. But he did his best to do it and, again, set himself up, I think, for 4 years hence.
Turning to a domestic policy issue, this was kind of interesting. Towards the end of the debate, there was a question about faith and its role in policy decisions made as a leader. Here's Senator Kaine now talking about the hotly contested issue of abortion.
We support Roe versus Wade. We support the constitutional right of American women to consult their own conscience, their own supportive partner, their own minister, but then make their own decision about pregnancy. That's something we trust American women to do that. And we don't think that women should be punished, as Donald Trump said they should, for making the decision to have an abortion.
And with that issue and with the death penalty, Senator Kaine talked about the contrasting views of his own faith being opposed to those things, but then his role as a public official not putting that in there. What did you make of that whole back and forth over abortion and faith between the two?
I thought that end point that they came to, I wish that they had come to it sooner and been able to delve into it more. I thought that was the most genuine point for both candidates because they obviously do have their very genuine feelings about faith and about religion. And the very fact that Senator Kaine has been a lifelong Catholic, Governor Pence began as a Catholic and then converted to evangelical Christianity, I think is fascinating. And then this conversation that they had about the death penalty and about abortion, I almost wish we could have had a half an hour on that. I would say about Senator Kaine, it's fascinating to me as someone who studies the Kennedy era, that of course this is exactly what John Kennedy said in his famous speech in September 1960 to the Protestant ministers in Houston, that Kennedy said, I have my faith, I have my own faith. No one asked me what my religious faith was when I went to fight in the South Pacific in World War II. No one asked my brother when he gave his life in World War II what his faith was. But he said, my faith is personal, my public policy is separate from that. That's exactly what Senator Kaine was saying last night.
So we've said, and a lot of people have said, probably the running mate doesn't matter all that much. The vice presidential debate probably doesn't matter all that much. Let me throw out a notion to you, see what you think of it, with the negatives of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I mean, we've heard in Wisconsin some people with the Republican Never Trump movement saying, I'll vote for the Republican ticket. I'll vote for Mike Pence. And, you know, so is there some sort of cover for these candidates with high negatives where people might look at their running mate and say, okay, there's something I like on that ticket. I'll get over my reservations about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton.
Yes, Rob, that's a very good point that you're raising, because your premise is sound. That is that typically people don't vote for the vice presidential spot, and that's why, in part, the vice presidential debates don't usually move the needle, although you could make a case that they did, and the needle moved in 2004 with Cheney, I think, had a pretty substantial victory over John Edwards in that debate. And they maybe people felt better in 2000 voting for Cheney, if you will, over Bush, who didn't have very much experience. So I think it can, and I think last night that's why it was a bit of a shame, I believe, for voters who might be looking not to vote for Trump but are not thrilled about Secretary Clinton. I think that Senator Kaine didn't give as good an accounting of himself as he might have if he hadn't been playing that attack dog role.
That was the only set of debates. This is a one and out for the vice presidential candidates. What are you watching for in rounds two and three for the presidential candidates?
Well, this will be more fascinating, I think, than last night, that we all, again, are more interested in the presidential debates. What will Donald Trump do, if anything, to change his demeanor and his approach this coming Sunday? And the other question for me is, how will he behave in a town hall format? So those are the two things I'm going to be looking for. He doesn't seem to have that natural empathy of a Bill Clinton who can go out into the audience and say, I feel your pain. I think Mrs. Clinton does a little bit better in that format. So again, what will he do, if anything, to change his demeanor from the first debate, which was so catastrophic for him? And second, how will he perform in this town hall setting?
Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to, as always, Rob.
That's Barbara Perry, professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. She joined us to talk about last night's vice presidential debate.